So welcome to Africa in Transition. This is Alan Grain. I am here with John Campbell, CFR's Ralph Bunch, Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies.
Good to be here.
I am also with Simon Freemantle, Senior Political Economist at Standard Bank Research.
Good afternoon.
Today we're going to be speaking about the complex politics playing out in South Africa. Simon, why don't we get started?
First is the last year and a half has been a compromising period for the president. He suffered a series of political setbacks initiated from shock to President Zuma's political base since he was elected and re-elected party and state president. Following that, last year we found the Constitutional Court judgment against him, we found the allegations formalized in the Public Protector's report about state capture, and then more than anything we saw the ANC suffer real electoral loss in the August municipal elections, where in urban areas in particular there appeared to be a fairly strong defiance against the symbolic importance of President Zuma. So last year was a bad year for him. Coming into this year, it appears as though senior leaders of his own party and in his own cabinet had appeared to assume a more defiant position against his authority. And many in his base had called on him to show strength. It's increasingly clear, and I think the markets have reflected that, that President Zuma appears to be weak, and he needed to show that that is not the case. And I think in some senses, recalling Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan was a show that he still has that authority to make that move. So that's the presiding sense that I got. Now, an undercurrent to that move appears to have been framed by two objectives. One was, it has since emerged, and I think there's credibility in this, that an intelligence report, and this intelligence report appears not to be have any substance, but it was delivered to the president over the weekend, and there were suggestions made, as fanciful, as ludicrous as these might seem, as indeed they are, that Pravin Gordhan was meeting international investors and delivering to them a message that they should only invest in South Africa when President Zuma is removed, which is an outrageous suggestion, and it lacks all fact. But it appears as though President Zuma believed that there was some something in that claim.
This report came from an intelligence agency?
The report is that it came from within the State Security Department within government.
But we know nothing else about it.
We know nothing else about it, right?
Okay.
Then the other aspect of this appears that there is some timing, a lack of coincidence in the timing between recalling Mr. Gordhan and the two court cases which are taking place this week, one between Mr. Gordhan and the Gupta family, and another on Thursday this week initiated by the Gupta family to try and force the courts or request the courts to force the Reserve Bank and the Finance Minister to approve their purchase through an affiliate of the local operations of a foreign bank called Habib Overseas Bank. So there are aspects.
Who are the Gupta family and why are they important?
So it's a family that arrived in South Africa. Three sons of a family arrived in South Africa in the 1990s. Their rise to political prominence has really coincided with President Zuma's arrival as state president. They've become a very powerful lobby group within the state political system. They seem to enjoy fairly close ties to the president and very close ties to one of his sons, Duduzani Zuma. The allegations are, and these were formalized in the report issued by the Public Protector last year, that they have used that access to influence the decisions that the president has taken, particularly in cabinet. So there are suggestions that, for instance, the mining minister has close ties to the Gupta family. And then, of course, the decision to appoint David van Rooyen instead of Nhlanhla Nene in December 15, there are strong suggestions as well that was a coordinated decision which had some implication between the president and the Gupta family. So the response to the Guptas and the resistance to the Guptas is coming to a great extent from within the ANC, that fears that if decisions are being taken with reference to an external party, almost irrelevant who that party is, that in itself asks questions about the institutional integrity of the ANC.
So this is, in part at least, an internal struggle within the ANC.
Absolutely.
Now, why does it matter who the finance minister is?
On a variety of levels, so on a very basic fiscal integrity and a investor confidence level, the finance ministry in South Africa has always been seen to be the most credible and most independent organ of the state. And historically in South Africa, we've always had national treasury gaining that perception, and it's been held up by having consistently good finance ministers, Trevor Manuel, and then of course Nhlanhla Nene and Pravin Gordhan. So that's the first thing. When it comes to the broader EM universe, South Africa differentiates itself by having a well-regarded, well-respected national treasury together with an independent and credible reserve bank. So on the one hand, much of South Africa's investor confidence that allows us to attract bond and equity flows, which helps us to sustain our current account balance, comes from that confidence. So that's the first point. The second, and I think this is why we've reached this point, is throughout the course of last year, Pravin Gordhan came to be seen as a symbol of more than just fiscal probity, but as a symbol of defiance against an erosion of the ANC's national popularity, an erosion of institutional strength in the system, because he was bold enough to stand up to defy aspects of the current administration that are a great threat to institutional fortitude in the country and to the ANC's electoral popularity. So he's assumed a more symbolic importance through that process, which is somewhat disconnected from the pure importance of the National Treasury.
Is it going too far to say that the finance minister is a symbol of reformist elements within the ANC?
It's not too far at all. In fact, what we found over the course of President Zuma's time in office is a resistance, a hesitance from many people who may find themselves opposed to the president, but in the ANC and in the ANC structure, you don't register that protest publicly. It's against ANC protocols and rules. Throughout last year, we found that people were more willing to come out in defense of Pravin Gordhan almost as a proxy for opposing the president. But rather than coming out publicly to oppose the president, you can do that through defending Pravin Gordhan and demanding that he not be dismissed.
That is an interesting and subtle point. So, in the South African system, it is easier to support the finance minister than to attack the party leader.
Yes, and I think we saw that, we've seen that to a great extent in the way that the ANC elders, for instance, have positioned themselves. So they have gone further. They have actually asked for leadership change in the ANC, which was a bold move from a group of very credible ANC elders. Many of them, obviously have congregated today, in fact, around Ahmed Kathrada's funeral. But typically, it is far more acceptable in the ANC structures to come out in defense of something rather than against something else, particularly in a sitting head of state.
Now, there is supposed to be a new party leader selected in December, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, is there any relationship between the efforts to either recall the finance minister or leave him in place and a struggle over the party leadership now only 7 or 8 months away?
I think there is a connection. My feeling is that the president still has, and we are seeing this in his expression of support for Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma to assume the leadership of the party in December, he still has a clear influence over that succession process. And he has the option to continue to support his preferred candidate in December, to rally support in the provinces for that outcome. And there is still a plausible environment in which that could manifest, in which case the president would have leverage beyond December this year. So the argument that he wants to replace Pravin Gordhan as a power play in light of December, for me, lacks some of that political logic, because rather play it safer and mobilize as he is already mobilizing at the provincial level, which is where you determine ANC election outcomes. So I don't think that there is an immediate connection between the manner in which the succession process is determined. But what there absolutely is an increased urgency from the president and his allies, given that the window of power is narrowing because he has 8 or 9 months left of functional power before there will be a transfer. And even if that transfer is to his preferred successor, there is still a degree of uncertainty as to how much leverage he will have over that outcome.
Now, bringing that up, is there any scenario where you see Zuma maintaining the presidency for the rest of his term?
As state president, yes. So in South Africa, there is no limit on party presidencies, but we have a two-term limit on state presidencies. I know you know that, but just for the interests more broadly. So in 2019, the president will have to step down. Now, if we if we assume that his preferred candidate for the ANC elections wins in December, and as it stands, that appears to be Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, then we have to imagine that a deal will be struck whereby President Zuma will see out his term until April, May 2019, when we have our next national elections. This is another argument why a strong play now, which would have real consequences to dismiss Pravin Gordhan, would compromise his capacity to negotiate that deal with whoever might replace him in December. So if we assume a reformist type of transfer of power takes place in December, the probabilities of President Zuma seeing out his term are certainly lower. There will certainly be the desire from whoever wins in December to offer an olive branch to the opposing faction, as it was when President Zuma won the ANC elections in December 2007, mm-hmm. He offered former President Thabo Mbeki the opportunity to remain as state president, and that did last until September the following year when Mbeki was requested to resign. So for a period of time after December, almost irrespective of the outcome in December, I think President Zuma will remain head of state. But it does depend on how he operates within the parameters that will emerge as a result of him losing party leadership and having to operate as state president within a new realm of constraints.
Now, the press, you all no doubt notice, the press in the United States is critical of Jacob Zuma on lots and lots of different grounds. Could you tell our listeners, or could you say to our listeners a word about where his political support comes from?
So within there is a disconnect in South Africa which needs to be resolved and will be over time as politics becomes more competitive, as the ANC's supermajority unravels. But just to start by emphasizing that in South Africa, the urbanization rate is currently about 65% and growing fairly rapidly. So in the future, it'll be impossible to have a ruling party that isn't primarily popular in urban centers. But as it stands, the ANC election process is dependent on the ANC membership across the provinces, and ANC and rural provinces tend to have a higher share of ANC membership than urban provinces. So Gauteng, for instance, which is 35% of GDP and has more people than any other province, has only 10% of ANC membership, whereas a province like Mpumalanga, which accounts for 6 or 7% of GDP, has 13% of ANC membership. So the reality is that President Zuma has been able to garner very strong legitimacy and support in the ANC structures, primarily because of the support within the ANC's more rural provinces. That's one aspect. The other aspect is, over the ANC's 100-year history, it has made a very distinct effort to balance its leadership on an ethnic basis. So that effort was in some cases drawn against when you had a consistent bias of ANC leadership towards the Eastern Cape and Gauteng, and primarily Nelson Mandela, Govan Mbeki, Thabo Mbeki, Walter Sisulu, Oliver Tambo. Many of the ANC's leaders had come from the Eastern Cape and were of the Xhosa group. So Jacob Zuma arrived and he offered KwaZulu-Natal the opportunity to become more resurgent. And as a result of that, we saw ANC membership in KwaZulu-Natal went from 12% to 27%. And now the ANC, the share of the ANC's vote from across the provinces at a national level, one in four votes that it was able to garner in 2014 came from that province. So it's been a dual process, playing very cleverly into the ANC's rural base and boosting quite profoundly the importance of KwaZulu-Natal in the ANC circles.
So it's a disproportionately rural constituency, disproportionately a Zulu constituency.
Rural more than necessarily than Zulu. I mean, President Zulu.
You would put more weight on the rural part of that than on the Zulu part of that.
Yeah.
And the system functions the way it does because within the ANC, the alignment of votes with population doesn't fit very well.
Yeah. So that has to be resolved. So just to reemphasize that point, you've now got an environment where the ANC controls a 62% national majority as a result of the 2014 elections. But as a result of last year's local government elections, where the ANC saw major voter slippage in the urban centers, they're effectively only in control of about half of the economy. Because in the four metropolitan municipalities that they now no longer control, and which the DA now controls, those four metropolitan municipalities on their own account for 45% of GDP. So over time, there needs to be a realignment of national majority party and urban control. And this is the disconnect that has become exacerbated under President Zuma. And this is why it's so important in December that the ANC elects someone who is primarily capable of regaining trust and legitimacy in urban areas. And the Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, you could clearly argue that he would be capable of recalibrating ANC support in Gauteng, for instance, where the loss has been most acute. And that dysfunctionality or that disjuncture in the system was hidden somewhat by the ANC's majority in the past, but also by the fact that the ANC has typically been led by elites who are primarily supported in urban areas, such as the former president.
Are we seeing an opening up of the political process in South Africa?
Absolutely. So I think what we're finding is many natural political forces are being, in some cases gradually, in other cases quite rapidly, unleashed by the unraveling of the ANC's majority. One of them is that the ANC can no longer afford to be as complacent. Now, in its move towards a slightly more urgent approach to appealing to voter sentiments, there will be a constructive approach towards, for instance, reducing corruption and improving delivery. There may in time, and I think we're already seeing the seeds of that, start to be more populist messaging. When you have a 69% majority, you don't necessarily need to pander to those sentiments because your majority is locked. And I think that competitiveness in the system will mean down the line that populism in various forms, right and left, will become a bigger theme in SA politics as the political terrain opens and the opening itself is brought about by the ANC's weakening.
So how is their opposition, the Democratic Alliance, and I guess the coalition that they've built, how are they doing? How do the voters think they're doing?
Well, I think they, together with the Economic Freedom Fighters, would want it to be emphasized that it's not a coalition. It's a mixed picture. The DA now controls these three metros, but let me focus on Johannesburg. This is where the DA faces three primary challenges in discernibly improving things on the basis of what their new management of this large and fundamentally important city. Number one, they don't have the majority. So they cannot make the argument that voters voted for change. They hold 38% of the metro vote. The ANC got 45%. So a very generous contribution to the DA from the EFF gives them that power, but it is a limited power in their capacity to wield 38% over 45%. Secondly, there is the inability to get easy wins as a function of the fact that the former Johannesburg mayor, Parks Tau, was well regarded. He had generally done the very basic things to improve governance, he inherited a billing crisis and he improved things quite strongly on the basis of that. There's been some fundamental improvements in the management and the financial affairs of the metro, which means that you're going to have to step things up even further to see early gains, and it's going to be very hard to do that. And thirdly, I think the DA chose relatively poorly in their mayoral candidate for Johannesburg, Herman Mashaba, who lacks political experience, and he seems to lack some of the political nous that you need to reach across the divide and run a metro in which you do face a hostile former ruling party, and in some cases, pockets of real electoral hostility as well. There's regions in his city in which the ANC secured 70, 80% of the support. And a bureaucracy that still envisages that at some point, perhaps not in the too distant future, the ANC will regain control of that metro when the EFF decides to pivot its support back to the ANC.
Got it. And one last question. So in 2019, does the ANC maintain the national majority?
Depends what happens in December this year. I think that if you see one of two outcomes, if you see a reformist kind of outcome in December, or if you see a muddle through, in which there's elements of reform, strong enough elements of reform, but there's also some pockets of the factions that currently surround the president. And a muddle through would probably be enough to allow the ANC to sustain the majority, a reformist ticket perhaps as well. An outcome in which the reformists are deemed to be isolated, I think you could well see another split in the ANC. And the ANC had already, in the 50s, cannot afford another COPE or EFF style split, because that 6 or 7% would be enough to nudge them below 50. So it does really depend on what we see happen in December.
Well, Simon, thank you. Ambassador Campbell, thank you. And thank you for tuning in to Africa in Transition.
Thank you very much.